I turn with you to consider what we read in Revelation chapter 7. That's just a reminder, and to remind you by means of just reading a couple of verses again. In verse 14 and 15, in verse 13, an elder, one of the elders, had spoken to John, and his answer, John's, was, "Sir, you know who are these." So he said to me, "These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will dwell among them." I hope you recall that there was a scroll with seven seals. And in the previous chapter we read of six of those seals, or the effect of them, what came about as they were opened. There is one still to be opened. It's one of the features that has often been noted by readers, commentators on the book of Revelation, that it has something of a repeated structure, a pattern that follows something like these few chapters here. Chapter 6 gives the first six of the seals. There is something of an interruption, an interlude, and then in chapter 8 you find in a big way the opening of the seventh seal, which is itself an opening into another succession of seven trumpets. It's an indication of the stylized record of this prophecy. And it in no way diminishes the impact that it should have as God's word. It is authoritative, but just the fact that it is stylized, that it is so precisely written in this form. John himself records what he saw, records it in this way. He was a holy man of God, inspired by the Spirit of God, to write as he did. There are indications that it is not a simple, shall we say, chronological sequence, that these things happened in precisely the order that he saw them, in precisely the order that they were. Or perhaps we should say that we don't know that they happened in that order. There is a climax almost under that sixth seal in chapter 6, where it seems to be speaking of the very end of things of this world, the great day of his wrath, the wrath of the Lamb. But then it's rather reverting back to see something that was to come before this. Either way, I speak about this for just a moment again. It's a reminder of the way that this is portrayed, the way that it is laid out before us, the things which must take place after this. Remember always that there, John has said he saw them in the Spirit. It's visionary. It's rich in symbolism. And that's not the same as saying that the things themselves are just mythical. It's the telling that we need to recognize. It's the way it's told. And this is an attempt to tell things that are unsearchable practically, that are beyond human description, I believe. And it is an attempt, it is the way that God has made it possible for a man to set things out using the limits of human perception and speaking to such limits as well. So, I have said some of these things before, perhaps in different ways, but always keep that in mind as we do go through this, that I think it's vitally important if we're to understand the references that are found here. So, amidst the traumatic scenes of the first six seals, there was destruction abroad. And amidst that, there was a glimpse, at least, of the security of those who had died for the sake of the Word of God and the testimony. But John here is learning more concerning those that God calls his own. And it seems that the three key things that this passage says about God's chosen people might be well outlined as the sealed, the saved, and the serving. And it really speaks of different, if you like, steps in their experience, or I trust our experience. What does it say about God's chosen people? It says, first of all, that they were sealed in this interlude. At this point, I'm looking chiefly at the passage through from verse 1 through to verse 8. Although we do need to keep in mind what follows in order, need to make reference to it to help our understanding of what is said in this first section. And I find this a wonderfully encouraging passage. I don't know how familiar you are personally with Revelation, but much of what goes on can be quite or even very disturbing. But I wouldn't suggest that any believer should steer away from it. It is the truth, after all. It is the way that God is telling these that this is the way things are to be. But if the way is dark, then, I was in company with, shall we say, an old-timer yesterday who was telling about the war years when she would cycle to her base where she worked, cycling in the dark, and she was just saying she didn't know how she did it. I don't know how she did it. In the dark, a glimpse of light is virtually essential, isn't it? It's vital for endurance and direction. And there is something of that in the way, again, that this cycle comes back over a number of times in the telling of the story of Revelation. And there is that in this chapter. But there are also reminders of the danger and that darkness. After these things, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth. That in itself is a sign of the way that this is symbolic language. We would use the term, perhaps, the four points of the compass. It's just using that kind of expression. Some people would say that that tells you how limited their perception was of what the world is like. That's taking it too literally. I think that's a false interpretation of something like this. It expresses it perfectly, doesn't it? It expresses the way that the wind from the north, south, east, and west, and there were the angels holding it back. I don't know about you, but I do meditate a great deal when I see something like the ocean, or look up in the sky, when you can see its expanse. Or you experience a thunderstorm, and I mean a real thunderstorm with its lightning and all the power of it. The awareness of the power of the elements that God has made, and he lets loose. But I do remember a few times being in the house and looking out and over the hill, and I could see something happening in the weather, and it told me there's wind coming. That's when I got scared. Wind is immensely powerful. Notice what it says, that the earth, the sea, or on any tree. It's almost strange that trees should appear there. But look what the wind does to trees. It's such powerful evidence of its strength, its destructive power. Look how it stirs up those very storms. See how it whips up that sea, how it fans the flames. What power it is. Chapter 6 finished with that major upheaval of the earth and nature. Chapter 8 that follows, when the seventh seal opens, it focuses on nature and the trouble that will come upon nature. And there, in between, in chapter 7, the wind is striving to run through this world, and it is held back, these four angels. And the one other angel that ascends from the east, he is carrying something with him. And he cries to these four angels and he says, "Don't let it come yet. Wait until we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." And those angels, they are surely God's servants. They're doing His work. They've been posted there to restrain the winds until God's time. When it was God's time, they would release it. That was what was meant by being, it was to them granted to harm the earth and the sea. And verse 3 indicates that that will happen. But it will only happen once, after the servants of God received His mark upon them. That's the sense of the seal in this place. It is the placing of God's mark upon them. That restraint that is spoken of in the, at the beginning, holding the four winds of the earth, that it should not blow on the earth, that restraint is on behalf of the servants of God that are introduced in verse 3. There is restraint of the power of evil even now on behalf of the servants of God. Let's think on it. We're not told, first of all, what they are being sealed for. The seal was being brought. I must seal till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads, verse 3. In verse 4, I heard the number of those who were sealed. It's simply saying that that was going to happen. It doesn't say why at the moment. And John saw them being sealed. He didn't see anything else being done with them. They weren't taken away before the winds should come. There was nothing of that kind. But it leaves me thinking on what the strength of a seal is. We might say, and ideally at least, in an ideal world, you put a seal on a document. It is to say, this can only be opened in certain circumstances by someone who's allowed to open it, who has that authority. Anyone could probably rip it open. It's not a thing that withstands human strength. But it places that mark on this document, this object, whatever it is. A document like that, if anyone has respect for the principle, the document might even go through the hands of people who don't want whatever it is that's in the document. They could be quite opposed to its contents, but it's safe because of that seal. Well, so much more. God's servants received His mark. And whatever would be thrown at them, anyone could see God's prior claim on them. To some degree, it may be a very extreme treatment that was to come. They may be beaten, they may be troubled, along with everyone and everything around them as well. This wind was to sweep through the earth and the sea. They might be troubled seriously, but that seal was upon them. They could know themselves, others could know, that God in His time was to return and reclaim them as His own. So they were sealed in preparation for all that was to come. And I heard the number of those who were sealed. Again, it's this abbreviated form. It is telling us that John heard a voice. Someone said, so many are sealed. He couldn't see it. It wasn't that he counted them or anything. He was told 144,000. And then that sequence of the tribes of Israel, 12,000 from each. I personally haven't gone into this in a huge amount of detail, perhaps, but you know there are some, such as the Jehovah's Witnesses, who seem to base a great deal on something like this. What does it mean? It is very hard. How can we interpret it literally? Within the context, within this the very nature of this book, how can we do that? And with what's around it? You could look at the 12 tribes that follow, but there are issues with it. It's not like any other list in the Bible anywhere. There are real peculiarities to it. Do you know? You come to this, do you know the tribes of Israel, the 12 tribes? It's worth knowing them. You'll notice some discrepancies, as it were. Where is Dan? Where is Ephraim? Who took such a lead in the Old Testament? Why are both Joseph and Manasseh his son given? And so on. Pretty well every list of such tribes is different throughout the Bible anyway. But how careful we must be. The other glaring difference between every other list in the Bible is of the tribes is how every tribe has exactly the same number. Very precisely so. It speaks of symbolism. It's saying something different. Not saying this precise number that we count. Remember what I said, he heard that number. He didn't count them himself. Who could count a crowd of 144,000 in any case? We need to go further. We need to pick up on John's next view. It's not a restricted number, but an endless number, one that he cannot count. A great multitude which no one could number. He says that precisely, deliberately, in verse 9. Of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues. Not just those named tribes of Israel. Is he speaking about the same people? I believe he is. The first is telling us that there is a specific number. It is God saying there is a specific number being made safe, although destruction will surround them. It's only the sealed who would be safe in that destruction. Or in other words, they are the ones who will be saved. But then we go on to read of a multitude who are saved, which no one could number. They are standing before the throne. That is speaking of those who are saved, taken out. It's the only way that you could be standing before the throne. It cannot happen without a seal. And if you were to say that's a literal 144,000 of the tribes of Israel, and then you go to verse 9 and you see a great multitude in the presence of the throne and before the Lamb, and they're from all nations and tribes, then there's a contradiction. I think it is better to realize that there is that symbolic numbering, as does appear elsewhere also in Revelation. If you know your arithmetic, you'll realize that 144 is the square of 12, and that 12 is one of the numbers of, it's certainly the number of the tribes of Israel, and I think it is one of the numbers of perfection. And there are also multiples of 10. 10 also is a perfect number, along with number 7, which appears in various other ways through Revelation. But I think what it is saying is, when John hears the voice, and it is surely the voice that God himself speaks, but he's speaking of something definite. Whereas when man looks, it is a vast, innumerable number, numbers that are impossible to count. But you see, God knows the number. God knows his people. He knows us precisely. He is perfectly capable of numbering his people. But he expresses it in this sense of perfection, completeness. When man looks at it, it is as God said to Abraham, look at the stars of the sky, can you number them? Well, your seed, the children of Abraham by faith, are like the stars of the sky. A great multitude of all nations and tribes and peoples. And it takes me back then to remind you. The reason I deal with that is because so many have touched on it and have come up with all sorts of interpretations of it. But I raise some of these questions and say, just remember the things that are there that are telling us to look at it in a somewhat different way and to realize the way that the whole thing is being told us. But there is a very simple statement that is in the middle of all of this, in verse 3, that the angels have come out to seal. Who do they put the seal on? The servants of our God. Ask yourself, who is the servant of God? They're the ones who are under God's protection. They're the ones that God will save. They're the ones who will appear and make up this great multitude in the presence of the throne and before the Lamb. And then to remind you again, just as we do speak of that, and just to remind you of the what is around those who are sealed, is this impending trouble, destruction, the power of these winds that would harm the earth and the sea and the trees. The blessing and the encouragement in the midst of that is, as one writer puts it, that here God is restraining the forces of destruction again, and he says this is the great master thought that informs this book. And that is a tremendous thing, that God is restraining the powers of evil and the destruction that that warrants. He's holding it back. He is caring for his people. And yes, at times Revelation can be very dark, but God is keeping himself a people. There is destruction all around, but it doesn't have the final say. It is not the great power. It is God restraining it that is very clear here. And his timing is he has it under his control. He is caring for his people. And he cares for his people to this point where they are also secondly saved. John signals his own new focus in verse 9, after these things. Doesn't necessarily mean chronological consequence and following, but it is the way that this was appearing to him, that he was being told these things. A new focus. Now he is seeing things as though they are complete. He has seen them before destruction was to sweep through these winds. But now there is something more complete. He saw it, remember, when in human history things were a long way from completion. But now he sees this great multitude. It gives a sense that now we can see things as they really are. It's at that point, in even in man's experience. And he sees this multitude assembled before the throne and before the Lamb. Said it already, they would not be there. They would not be there in white robes unless they had been delivered, truly saved, into God's presence. His own people, his servants, delivered by him. And that's what they devote their hearts to, crying out in verse 10 with a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne. They knew it for what it was. They will know it. You will know it if you trust in him now. Will you know it? Is that yours, your great hope? And that you may be there also singing, knowing very clearly salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. I must say it again here. I have said earlier that this is another passage that must give us great encouragement. It holds great promise for God's people as to what God is doing on our behalf. But I want to emphasize once again what that is all about, what God is doing, working for his people. What do we see these saved people doing? We hear them there in verse 10. We hear them again in verse 12. Their object is the praise of God. In verse 12, it tells us they are giving thanks. Yes, they're aware of what God has done for them. I use the third person there, as John himself has done. It is them, it's they who have been doing it. But it must be the desire and the object of all of God's people for you today. Receiving these great benefits of salvation, realizing that the honor and the devotion belongs only to him. That he is the one to whom our attention must turn. We are incapable of attending to any of these things in this life. It will be the greatest delight then to be turned to him And that will answer all those aches that we know now for fulfillment and for satisfaction. That's where it's heading. That's where we too must be looking, looking on Him. There is this conversation with the elder, verses 13 and 14. One of the elders, yes, it's that word answered, literally, that is what it says. Is there an implicit question? I'm not sure. But the elder asks him. It's a question that is to raise a question and to find the true answer. Who are these? These people, this array of white robes, who are they? Where have they come from? He turns to the elder, and I'm so struck with John's answer. John is an apostle of the Lord, and he doesn't know. Doesn't know the answer to this. We find the answer. We're blessed that we have been given the answer through John. But how sure of ourselves we so often are. Yet here was John, impressed with the presence of the Lord himself and of those who serve him in such roles as the elder. And he simply is ready to say, I don't know. You know. Please tell me. Guide me. Just perhaps a caution for each one of us that we do take great care and not be overconfident in speaking of things that we do not understand, and how much in Revelation particularly. But the reminder comes out of these words, out of this conversation, the reminder of the salvation of the multitude. It's that language of deliverance again, to come out of the great tribulation. What else can you call it? It is deliverance. It is salvation. And that's the one qualification that belongs to all of these. Except you can go perhaps a little deeper and say, now how were they brought out of that tribulation? We'll come to that in just a minute. But this is the one qualification, to come out of the great tribulation. But you know what that leaves me wondering? Is how limited the great tribulation is. This is all of God's people who are saved in His presence. And many will interpret the great tribulation in the book of Revelation when it's referred to as something of specific duration that has a specific setting in the overall course of history. But I'm left wondering if that is really valid. If it's talking about these people, these who are before God in their white robes, they're the ones who are out of the great tribulation. Is the great tribulation perhaps something that is the ongoing, it is the enduring tribulation of those who will come to God through faith? Let's bear that in mind as we go on and come to it also along the way in the book, in the prophecy. Is this a reference to that persistent and we might say multi-era trouble of this world, that enduring opposition to those who are of the gospel of the kingdom? And then there is one of the great contradictions of this symbolism. We need to be very careful how we use it. It has often been used and it has become part of Christian jargon, that you must be washed in the blood of the Lamb. You know what I mean? It has a certain ring to it, doesn't it? But you cannot literally make anything white by washing it in blood. And how simple it is, and how little we've paid attention to it. Because there are people out there who know the literal reality, and they say, what are you talking about? Do we know what it means? It is symbolic language. It is reminding us of wonderful truth. But let's beware how we use such words. It is an allusion, of course, to the cleansing of hearts from sin through faith in the sacrifice of Christ Jesus, whom John called the Lamb of God, in order to remind us of the blood that has to be poured out, life to be given for sin. Christ made that sacrifice himself. He is the one described as the Lamb in this book. He gave himself for sin. He gave his blood. And it's that alone, through faith, that makes a man righteous before God. and it's that righteousness which is signified in Revelation by these white, these clean robes, white appearing before the Lord of glory. So there are these who have trusted in the Lord and his word. They've washed their robes, they've made them white in the blood of the Lamb. It's because of that trust that the Lord has sealed them, they are his servants, he has preserved them, and he's brought them out of that great tribulation into his presence. That's the sequence that is behind this. And I simply say, well, perhaps you know these things, but learn to be sure of being able to explain them step by step in words that mean something to people around us, not just the folk who are familiar. And perhaps I've done the same, used words even there. I've only summarized it. Words that you and I are so familiar with that we don't realize that they still don't communicate with people around. Let's be very careful taking things and using them in the wrong place, in the wrong way. That's just perhaps a little bit of a tangent from what's there, but do bear it in mind very much. And it is wonderful still to be reminded ourselves of that step, that progression of the work that God does in order to bring these people into that throne room before the Lamb. And then the chapter closes with the promise of precious benefits for these saved ones. And I will just reread the few words there from verse 15, the last part of verse 15, through into verse 17, and urge you to take them and think upon them. He who sits on the throne will dwell among them, a benefit, a blessing. They shall neither hunger any more nor thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any heat. For the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living fountains of waters. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Do keep those in mind also, the blessings for the saved ones. But in the middle is a short word. Not only will these saved ones sing, praise, bow down, honor, worship the Lamb and God, but they will also serve him. Just in verse 15, it just says it once, although they are called also the servants of God, remember. They are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. The consequence of being delivered from sin, washed, made clean, delivered from destruction, sealed and saved, there they are, before the throne, serving him day and night. Remember what the temple is. It's the place where God is pleased to live among his people. And they will serve the saved ones. A result of their salvation. That salvation is the result of their faith. But everything in this scene points to a full awareness that it is entirely God's work on behalf of those who believe. The result is that they serve, they return, they respond and serve day and night. Let's just consider, is this saying something to us even for now? We are in a time of our lives that is for preparation for these things, another reason why we should dwell on them. And we don't serve him day and night, do we? We may attempt to, we may take what we were talking about this morning and plead with God's grace so that we may do so more and more. It is incomplete, surely. But this is the way it will be. It's something to encourage us towards that. It is also to remind us of what thankfulness means. It is out of thanksgiving that they do this. Serving him. There is a great deal that may need to be said about this one word. What does service mean? And perhaps we can come back to that another time, certainly not tonight. But to remember, to be thankful for all that God has given, all that God has promised. And as Paul says, that we should build substantially upon what has been possible so far, desiring to live no longer for themselves, but for him who died for them and rose again. That's what these saved are doing in the throne room of God. I must close. Forgive me for going on a little long. Paul wrote in Romans chapter 8, verse 30, whom he predestined, these he also called. Whom he called, these he also justified. And whom he justified, these he also glorified. I think he was reflecting something of what John saw here. There were those who were sealed. God places his mark upon them so that no one and nothing can snatch them out of his hand. Remember, it was John who wrote that down in John chapter 10, that promise of God. It's because of that that they shall be saved. That belongs to those who have trusted in him, the work being God's upon their lives. And so they shall live with him, taken into glory. Living with God will mean then at last that they will serve him as has never before been possible. That should be your desire, my desire. That surely must be glory for a man to live. They, whom John saw, is that you? I believe it is for many of you. But be sure it is. That you are among those that God will be pleased to seal, to mark as his own. It is, in every trace, it is the work of God and the Lamb alone. It's his preserving. All the way through to his cleansing, his rescue from trouble, his rescue from destruction. And it's only ever on that basis that true service can follow. And so make sure you are in that number. 144,000, don't let anyone tell you that's all it is. It's a number that cannot be counted. There is place for you. But make sure you're in that number. That you are known by God. That you would be in a number that he knows, but that is overwhelming to men. Because it is God's doing that he should take care of you in this glorious way. Without it, well, let's read on another time. May God bless his word to each one of us.